Hello, Student One Planner community. Today, I have a special treat for you. I have the founder of YNAB, You Need a Budget, Jesse Meekum, on the show today. Welcome to the Student One Planner podcast, Jesse.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here, Travis.
I'm a big fan of YNAB. I just want to say that right now. This is not a sponsored thing. When I found out we had an opportunity to have you on the podcast, I was like, heck yes. I use YNAB for my own personal budgeting, like probably a lot of the people that you are on podcast for. I think it's great. Can you tell our listeners, for the uninitiated, what is YNAB? What the heck is it? And what does it do for you?
Yeah. So YNAB, it's just a short way of saying you need a budget. We are firmly of the opinion that everyone needs to make sure that their money is lining up with what they care about. And that is a budget in its truest form. So we're really an education company that masquerades as a software company. We try and teach people how to think about their money differently and more productively and with less guilt. And then we sell software to keep the lights on and pay the bills.
So this software, just to talk like a little business stuff, right? So you've got that freemium model, the Facebook model, where everything's free, but they sell your information to everyone, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the Mint.com model, right? I started out with Mint, and it's interesting because like people don't really know this. I do affiliate marketing, and I know this because it's just the way the world works, right? They sell your information to all these different credit cards and different things, and they pitch you on products. That's not really y'all's model. Y'all's model is charging a fee for service. Can you tell us a little bit about why you decided to go down that model versus sort of the ad-based freemium model?
Yeah, you know, why I think we've just kind of slowly evolved into it more than anything else. Back in the early days, I was just trying to make some money to survive and get through school. So I didn't have any big strategic discussions. I didn't have a board that I was talking to about these decisions. And frankly, at that time, the idea of selling your information as a business model was new or hadn't yet been totally invented. So for me, I was picking what everyone else was doing at the time and just going on our merry way. But now, as you see just how the world's kind of evolved and you look at how data is monetized, I love that a customer of ours knows how we make money, and it is by the customer handing us the money. I think it makes for a better app experience. I think it incentivizes your designers to build an app that maximizes the user's use of it instead of maximizing clicks on ads. And so I think it aligns you more directly, and I don't know, it's a little more pure to be just aligned with your customer in that way. If they like what they get, they pay you. If they don't, they leave, versus trying to have some kind of behind the scenes monetization strategy. Not to say that they don't maybe have their place in one form or another, but in the finance space, I love that we just get to be paid directly.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell our listeners, like the biggest benefit I've gotten out of YNAB personally is just how it automatically uplinks all of your transactions from different companies. And then you can name those the way you want. And it kind of shows up in your profile. So for example, when I became an employer, I had all these different taxes that I was paying. And it was so confusing. There's unemployment taxes, there's payroll and corporate taxes. And then in my city where I live, there was even local income taxes and payroll taxes and all these different things. And so a lot of times I couldn't remember what I had paid when and in to whom and for what. And then also same thing with like charitable giving. It was chaotic. I was managing it in my own spreadsheet. And having YNAB is something that gave me the organization in my financial life where if I do have a question for tax time or who did I pay what and when, I'm able to pull that up. And I can even look at that like from 2019 or 2020 and then compare our monthly spending and even figure out what our number is for financial independence based off of tracking my spending. So I just wanted to say, like, tangibly, people, I think, would really benefit from this, especially the more complicated your life is. The more confused you are about your finances, the more benefit you could get from this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let me ask you this. In terms of doing something like signing up for YNAB, we tell people that if you track your spending, you're going to cut out a bunch of spending that you didn't even know that you didn't miss. Have you found that to be the case? And what are your experiences for people signing up for YNAB on improvements in their spending?
What we're really trying to do is just build the awareness muscle. And what you'd alluded to earlier, you know, that situation where things are very complex, we call it taming the chaos a lot of the time. What we want is for people to feel control. And chaos never feels like control. And the first step is to start to kind of gather that information and just start to build that awareness muscle. So for us, when we start to show people what they're spending on some category, and we never prescribe, you know, don't spend here, don't spend there, spend on this or that. We just try and build awareness. And then people with that heightened awareness can then decide, oh, okay, I really don't want to spend so much money eating out, which we see as the most common place where they cut. Not that anything's wrong with eating out. It's just what people naturally do when they start to cut. And so it's a situation where the awareness is what people need, and that's what we're trying to give them. And then they make really good decisions once they're fully aware.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of scared with all the apps that I've signed up for, you know, like because I switched from Android to Apple, and I think I've got a bunch of subscriptions to like the Weather Channel app and all these different things like I'm not even aware of. I'm stunned at like how many transactions that I identify that were fake transactions, or like a hotel like charged me incorrectly for room service or something, just because I've got that being pulled through automatically versus back in the day I did it on a spreadsheet, which is actually how you started. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got started with selling a spreadsheet that developed into this big business, just for those business-minded entrepreneurial type folks out there?
Yeah. My original impetus, I mean, we, you know, my wife and I, Julie, she and I married young. And then we also decided to have our first baby when we were still very young. And Julie was the breadwinner of the family at the time. And I was trying to hustle through school. And when it was time for, well, about a year before the baby was going to land and we were starting to kind of plan and things, we really wanted Julie to just be able to step out of the workforce and focus on being a brand new mom with this brand new baby. And I had the problem of still needing to finish school and not being able to work a ton. But we just decided that this little spreadsheet that she and I had used to help scratch money together, that we could maybe sell it. And so I thought if we could sell the spreadsheet enough to make about $350 a month, that would cover our rent that was dirt cheap at the time. And we could make it through school without borrowing money and with Julie being able to step out of having to earn the money. And with both of those things as kind of our non-negotiables, the creativity just popped where I thought, oh, I could sell this spreadsheet. And then the learning began. You know, how do you do this? How do you build a website? How do you launch it? How do you market? And, you know, you just kind of learn as you go. But I didn't have any grand aspirations as far as entrepreneurial things go. I wanted to be an accountant and make a steady paycheck, provide for the family, check, check, check. You know, so this all was unplanned, but I'm still very grateful for it.
But before you wanted to be a CPA, I read that you wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe you can kind of tell people about your extremely intense, I guess is the way I would call it, just workout and wake up schedule.
I wouldn't call it intense. It's fairly regimented. But in the school year, when the kids are all going to school, I get up before 5, about 4:40 usually, and get my workout in. And then I get some reading in. And then the kids, by that point, they're starting to get up and you got to get the kids out the door. And we have 7 of them. So it's no joke, you know, getting all those people mobilized or keeping a few of them immobilized actually is part of the game as well. But for me, getting up early and knocking out the workout, getting the blood flowing, it's just always been a good start. I've tried working out later in the day. I tried trying to do it at night, you know, from 9:30 to 11 and then jump back into work and saw it as some kind of a break. But I always lean back toward that early. I did that in high school still. Just, I liked getting up early, getting things going. My friends would call me at 8:30 p.m. and I was asleep. You know, my parents would be like, he's already in bed. So, you know, you pay for it on the social side, perhaps. And I just didn't go to all the fun social things because I was in bed at 8 p.m. But that's just what I fell into, where I landed that felt comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, anytime somebody wakes up before 5 a.m., I'm always, you know, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Do you have to catch a flight? You're like, no, I do this every day, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, in terms of growing an empire, right? So we've got, I think, a lot of dentist, physician types, lawyer types that run solo businesses and may not necessarily have the aspirations of having a lot of employees. And I don't think that's necessarily how you started off, but I kind of have been following you for a while. Saw that 2016, you did an interview talking about I think 40 something employees. More recently, I think that number was over 110, 120 or something like that.
Yeah.
What has been the reason for that growth? What have you been needing the most hiring wise with your growth of this? I would call it a big Mint competitor, right? Because a lot of people have heard of that, but I don't think a lot of people necessarily heard of YNAB as a smaller competitor. So what would you say that explosive growth has been going into?
Well, we're always hiring someone that we wish we would have hired a year ago, you know? So you always feel like you're behind in that regard. We're really picky. And so that means we just can't hire anyone. But you're always looking and just seeing every next hire is pretty obvious or really obvious. You're painfully obvious even. If you're measuring your success by your employee headcount, I think you're looking totally the wrong space. You need to look at your top line, at your revenue, at profits. You know, those profits that are left at the end of the day, how are you reinvesting them? And for us, we're people driven, totally and completely. So we put a lot of effort in our support, making sure that when people chat to us, we actually respond in chat in a fast, like it's an actual chat and not an email. With our email responses, we get out there very quickly and respond. On social, we're quick, because we're trying to change people's behavior. We're trying to get them to think about their money differently. And it's about education. It's not about AI for us. And in that instance, we've hired for support like crazy and hired engineers just as fast as we can find the ones that fit well with us. And we're just hustling as quickly as we can to get those people that we need that also fit. You never hire fast and wrong. That would be poor form. You want to hire correctly, even if it's a little slower.
With the pandemic, obviously, you had a lot of weird, really weird phases of it, right? I'm speaking from a personal finance perspective specifically, where in the early part of the pandemic, I remember people were sort of semi-panicking about not having enough money. And then as you had some of the big stimulus bills got passed, like consumers started to have more money. And then as the economy actually did okay, all things considered, especially for knowledge workers and, you know, professionals in our audience, people ended up having more money than they thought they were going to have. I'm curious what you've seen people asking questions about with YNAB and the reopening that's in the process of happening. What are people budgeting and saving for? What are people asking questions about what comes next from a cash flow perspective?
Yeah. I mean, we don't prescribe specific steps that you should take to reach financial independence or even financial control. I mean, everyone's a little bit different, but there tend to be big milestones that are kind of along the way. For many, when they're first starting, they just kind of need to get their hands around what's going on. And so you're kind of saying, hey, let's not change any behavior. Let's just track and learn a little bit. And then from the learning, you do start to get some behavioral change where people will cut expenses that they find out really weren't lining up well with what they truly care about. And we're starting to teach them the trade-offs where we're saying, if you do this, you won't be able to do that. And then they're like, well, that's more important. And you say, oh, well, that's good. Now we're experiencing trade-offs and some of this artificial scarcity. And so in that way, we're walking people through just their own priorities. And in the pandemic, you saw those priorities, as you mentioned, really change out from underneath people, where at first they're like, yeah, my priority is to go on vacation this summer and have a good time and maybe pay cash for it. And they're really feeling good. And then suddenly their priority was like hunkering down and being safe and hanging onto a job for dear life. And then it morphed. And now you see people with savings rates that we haven't seen in decades and decades. You know, 30% plus in the US for a savings rate in 2020 was because people were essentially saying, I don't know what I should care about, so I'm just going to hold on to this money. Now that that's starting to loosen up a little bit, people's prioritization muscles are still the ones being used. And they're saying, hey, we have this extra money. Do we want to accelerate pay down of some student loans? Or maybe not, because we had that pause for a while or whatever it was. And now they're saying, well, what do we want to do? And it's just going back to the budget and experiencing those trade-offs and saying we could do this, but that means we couldn't do that. That's what we want people to do again and again. Many people got rid of a lot of unsecured debt because their student loans were paused for a bit. And so when we did surveys of the YNAB community, which is a pretty good cross-section of aware, but not, they're all over the income spectrum and all of that. A lot of them just tackled a lot of that unsecured debt. I actually read in the Wall Street Journal just recently that credit card companies, these big banks, were really struggling to figure out where they would find the profits that they weren't getting from all of the interest and fees that had kind of been lopped off because people started paying that stuff down.
Well, we got the child tax credit monthly payments that are starting in July going until December. That's another big pot of cash are going to get. Yeah. I mean, so in terms of all this extra money, tons of savings rates, I guess one question I've got is there anything out there in just the personal finance space that makes you concerned that people might be jumping into something that maybe they aren't thinking about the right way from a budgeting standpoint? So the obvious example right now is housing. In you know, our local market, most of the houses in that sort of middle to upper middle class range are going for 50 to 100K over asking price. And I think our market's not even the worst of the worst. It's just sort of a above average bad, but not nearly as bad as it is everywhere.
Yeah.
What do you think, I guess, first, just about what's going on with people maybe wanting to make these huge purchases because of just all this pent-up demand and limited supply going on? Is there any kind of advice you have for people that are feeling like they're never going to achieve their dreams because of the rising prices we're seeing?
Yeah. I remember that feeling. It was 13 years. No. It was more than that. It was 15 years ago where Julie and I, you know, YNAB at the time was making a little bit of money and I was working part-time as well. And we were squirreling away what was going to be a down payment for a house. And this would have been in 05. I was born and raised in Phoenix. And so my parents were down there and we were thinking I would take my accounting job down in Phoenix. And we were looking out in this place. I can't remember. Buckeye was the name of the place down in Arizona. If you're from there, you would know it. And if you grew up there, you'd be like, Buckeye, is that even a place? When I was a kid, it was nothing. You would never go out there. And then in 2005, it was this place with all of this housing. And Julie and I, still with a year of school left, were of the feeling that, gosh, if we don't lock up a house and get under contract, we'll never be able to afford one. Well, fast forward 18 months and you could barely have paid someone to buy that house from. I mean, it was just all flipped upside down. So the feeling of being on the sidelines and feeling like that will always be the case, I don't think the always part is accurate. You can feel on the sidelines. You can feel like you're missing out. That's all valid. But to say we will never or we will always, I think that's where we can get into trouble. I am really grateful that Julie and I talked ourselves out of jumping into some home for way more than it was actually worth. For me to have an hour-long commute, it wouldn't have been great. But that feeling is strong. We'll never be able to save up enough to outpace this growth. This growth can't last. By definition, it can't last. Fast forward this growth 10 years and look what it would do. It can't last. So we just got to be kind of take a deep breath, recognize this may be for a season, but it will end and things will normalize again.
Personally, I think live in a house that's cheaper than what you could afford. I mean, what advice would you have for somebody that still feels like, you know, now's the time, I've got kids, I've got to buy a house? What would you say to that person maybe about maybe having a smaller appetite for the size of the house they're going to live in so that they can afford to be a little more aggressive?
I mean, if you can afford a home comfortably and still hit your other goals where the budget's saying this still works, you're able to save for retirement at a healthy rate. The standard 15% that goes toward retirement, I think, is a little weak. I mean, that's great. It's better than zero. But I think 25% is more intriguing. In that regard, your budget will tell you what you can really afford. Home ownership is not the same as renting. Not at all. They're completely different transactions. It's not just about shelter. It's really people saying, okay, I want to own this home because I want to improve this home, because I want to do upgrades, because I want to have, I mean, you buy a home and then you buy a list of things that you will spend money on to make it more the way you want it. And that's just the way it is with renting, very different transactions. So recognize that maintenance, repairs, and desired improvements are all a cost of home ownership, and make sure that those are included in your calculus. But at the end of the day, if you can afford something and you feel good about it and the budget is saying it's okay, then go for it. I bought a house in 2008 that still wasn't a great time in Utah, and we bought high. And then 10 years later, we sold it for a little more than we'd paid for it. And now, you know, I said, I wish I would have held onto that house. It's, you know, almost doubled in value in this crazy time. But you buy a home because it's a home, not because it's an investment. So treat it more like your home. And don't worry so much about the timing and all of that. It's your home, you know?
Yeah. So you have a four rule method for managing money. Could you explain what that is and how it could help people?
Yeah. The first rule is to give every dollar a job. So if you're giving something to A, you maybe can't do B. And we're trying to have people start to do the trade-off exercise because that's how priorities are fleshed out. If you could do everything, we would never know what your priorities are. But if you can only do a few things, your priorities start to come to light. Number two is to embrace your true expenses, meaning you think about your larger, less frequent expenses, and you break them up into smaller monthly amounts. Now you're considering not just Travis presently that has these obligations, but also future Travis. And it's like future Travis and current Travis are both talking. And they're both like, well, what do you need? And future Travis is like, I'm going to be on the side of a road with a broken down car and I'll need a tow truck. And current Travis is like, well, I don't want that. So they both agree, well, let's throw some money toward car repairs and handling those kinds of things. And then future Travis is like, I want to have a pretty good Christmas. Like, I want to be able to do some nice things for Christmas. And current Travis is like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Absolutely. And future Travis is like, can I go on vacation? Current Travis is like, yeah, okay. It's, that's the kind of negotiation that we have, where you're not just doing trade-offs for what you want now and how it affects things now, but you're recognizing that the trade-offs now affect future things, and you want to have them both in consideration. That's when good decision-making really comes to light. But then you back up and you go to rule three, and you say, okay, rule three is to roll with the punches. And that means we can change our plan whenever we want. So future Travis and current Travis have decided on a plan. They're in agreement. 3 days later, something happens and they have to come back again and say, should we change our plan? Because they just didn't know. I say they incorrectly because we're talking about one person. But these priorities of future and present both didn't know that there would be this thing that would pop up. So we have to recognize that a budget needs to be flexible. Rigid budgets break. And we want budgeting to be a process of ever allocating and ever deciding where money should go and what it should do. And our final rule is to age your money. We want to bring people back from the financial edge. And we want to have people earn money today that they won't need for at least 30 days, stepping back from that paycheck to paycheck cycle. If you follow the first three rules, the fourth rule tends to just kind of check its own box.
Yeah, that's really good. So a lot of our people are residents or make lower incomes, and then they get their degrees or they finish their training, and then they have much higher incomes all of a sudden. It's sort of a sudden wealth effect, right? So when you say give every dollar a job, what happens when you've got somebody that's basically got suddenly an influx of all these new dollars that are sitting around not doing anything, you know, unemployed? Where do they tend to go? And how do you avoid any kind of mistakes that happens when you have sort of that sudden wealth effect from a much higher income?
Yeah, I like to play games with myself when I get little windfalls or whatever. Mine and Julie's rule is that any windfall or kind of big bonus or unexpected positive thing, that half of it we save just out of the gate. Sometimes we save more, but half of it we'll always save. And that's just so we can kind of say, hey, from this, we made actual progress. Progress is made when you save money, not when you make money. So we have to make sure that if we desire financial progress, that saving is always top of mind. So you could have some aggressive rule. You could say, well, I want this base. I'll say one thing. A lot of these people that go through a ton of school and they've really sacrificed a lot and they've really lived tight. And then suddenly they have all this money and the desire to be like, hey, I've earned this is really strong. And I think you should respect it. I think you should say, yeah, I have earned this and I have lived a way that I didn't want to live that way forever. And now let me enjoy a little bit of the reward. I think you should enjoy it. I just think you should enjoy it with some constraints. I think you should say, how can we enjoy this? Like, how could we celebrate? What could we upgrade here that would be fun, you know? And call it out. Call it out as enjoyment. Don't call it out as a need. Don't deceive yourself. It's all wants, but just kind of call it out and say, hey, let's celebrate. And then celebrate. Really own it. The way you can do that without feeling guilty is by making sure that all of your priorities are being met. So if your priority is also to pay off some hefty debt, then work on that. If your priority is to save up for a down payment on a home, be working on that. Save for retirement? Absolutely. Buy the building that your practice is going to be in? Very cool. Things like that where you're saying, I am making progress. Boats are not progress, but they are fun. See if you can't do both along the way. Have a clear idea of what financial progress is versus what financial enjoyment is. You can do both. They're not mutually exclusive, but be clear about what is doing what.
I have kind of an interesting case I had with this surgeon, a future surgeon who was in training, and he had saved up an unbelievable amount of money for somebody that was in training, maybe $100,000, $200,000 or something on a, you know, $60,000, $70,000 budget. And he really wanted to drive a Tesla, but he had guilt. You can have financial guilt both ways. You can have guilt because you're constantly spending money, you never have enough, you feel like you're doing everything wrong. And I think you can also have guilt from the other direction where you feel like you need to save every dollar. You can't spend anything. Yeah. You need to be a miser, right? And so he was more on that end of things. And he was going to get loan forgiveness, had this great savings rate as a trainee. So it's pretty obvious that he's going to have a huge savings rate as an attending, right? Mm-hmm. And he could not bring himself to go buy that Tesla, which is his little splurge dream when he's working 80 hours a week and everything. And I know you did something like that a few years back. Could you talk about big purchases for the people out there that do have the really high savings rates, that are kind of the people that have guilt on spending money on themselves? What is a way to give yourself permission to do something like that?
Yeah, you got to go back to the budget. Make sure that all of those, you've thought of all of the jobs. If you're feeling guilt, this is why the idea of can I afford this or should I buy this, that kind of thing, it's such a stressful question. Because if you can't afford it and you buy it, you definitely feel guilty and have some negative effects. If you can afford it and you buy it, but you don't know you can afford it, you feel guilty too. So both ways, the person that can and can't afford it, both feel guilty for the purchase. And that's no way to live. So What we want to do is make sure that all jobs you've brainstormed and you've thought, okay, these are all the things that my money could, should, I want, need that to do, all of them. Then you fill those jobs, you allocate every dollar and you say, okay, do I still have money left over? Is there anything I'm forgetting? Is there something else that I want to do? Avoid should. Should is such a nasty, uninstructive word to use. But what do I want still? And if maybe you think of something else, you throw that on the budget as well. You feed that category. At the end of the day, somewhere along the lines, you'll recognize, my word, I've been super thorough on all the things that I want my money to do. And I still have, you know, this is a great problem to have, but you're like, I still have money left over. That means you can afford things that you want. I have a buddy, Mark, that does a lot of coaching for high earners. And he says, there's no such thing as a need and a want. It's all want. Don't be lazy and say, oh, well, that's a need, so I'll never think about it. They're all just wants at varying levels. I want shelter for my kids, high level, right? I want my kids to have a private tutor for such and such. That's somewhere way down the list, right? So they're all wants. And if we're clear on all of the wants that we could have and we've funded them appropriately and we just can't think of anything else, you probably can afford it. But this coming from a guy that had his therapist finally tell him, hey, just buy the Tesla. It sounds like you would enjoy it. That's literally like verbatim what she said. I think you should buy the Tesla. It sounds like you would enjoy it. And that I finally got my permission. I'd have an external third-party professional give me permission to buy the Tesla. But it was quite the upgrade.
Why do you think that was? Like, why do you think that you suffered from such a significant amount of guilt about not buying it?
It wasn't guilt. I think I had an identity issue with it, to be frank. I enjoyed this identity that I built for myself around, I mean, this is just for me, like internally where I thought, oh, I make good money. I've got this business. The business is doing well. It's profitable. Things are great. Julie and I are saving for retirement. We're fully funding stuff. And I drive this 02 Honda Civic, great little car. And I think I just had pride that it's like, oh, look, and I still don't have to buy some fancy car because look at me. It was a little bit of that. It was this identity around like frugal, but don't have to be, that I finally could shed a little bit. There are still remnants of that identity. Absolutely. But it was more that than feeling guilty about it. I felt like I was violating my identity a little bit. So the therapist gave the permission.
Yeah, I was a little more extravagant than you. I drove an 04 Honda Civic.
Oh, that's, but, wow. High roller.
Yeah, but yeah. No, but then we upgraded that because my wife didn't feel safe driving it on the interstate because it would rattle a little bit when you press the brake. And it's sort of like, well, wow, like this is a good lesson in marriage, right? You got to take more than just one person's view into account.
Absolutely.
One thing that you're an expert in is taking care of kids because you've got a lot of them. In terms of things that people want to adopt kids or have kids or thinking about that in their future, because there's all this talk about the cost of kids, which is very real.
Oh, yeah.
What are some ways that people could mitigate that fear or that impact on their finances so that they could plan ahead?
Yeah. I mean, there's the cost of literally delivering the baby, and you probably have some OBGYN people that are like, yeah, it's expensive. So there is that cost, but you know, you save up for it and it's a manageable thing. You can really get ahead of that and figure out exactly what it'll be. The actual cost of raising the kids, I think it's overblown. I think all the things that you see in stores that you supposedly need, it's just really good marketing. And they're marketing to a very, very vulnerable population. And I don't mean the baby. I mean the parents that think, oh gosh, I need everything. I will say, we with our seventh that was born a year ago, we bought a video monitor. And I'd always kind of laughed at the video monitor. I was like, God, you have to like monitor them. I mean, really? We really need that? The other six didn't. But that actually I liked. We'd be able to look over and be like, oh yeah, he's fine. And then you go to sleep and you're good to go. So I kind of ate my words on the video monitor. But a lot of the stuff, the toys, the classes, as kids get older, you got to put them in this and that sport and schedule them like crazy. And they have to pick their specialty when they're seven. I just don't buy any of that. I mean, this is not my expertise, but I'm not a parenting expert at all. We're all doing experiments on all these kids, you know, and we're trying to do as best we can. But the idea that they're out of the gate expensive is just not true. Give them a dirt field and a broken washer and watch the magic happen. You know, like they'll figure out fun things to do.
My daughter, she's 9 months old. Her favorite toy is a plastic cup. You know, she's got all these other baby gifts around her that friends and we bought for her, and she just wants to hold crinkly like paper and a plastic cup and smash them together. I will say, though, if my wife was sitting here next to me, what she would speak up with and say is, well, wait, what about professional women working that don't necessarily have a stay-at-home spouse? Childcare expense, obviously, in a lot of parts of the country can be $3,000-$4,000 a month in some places. We kind of solved that issue by identifying that her parents were willing to live anywhere in the country. And so we kind of looked for jobs where they were okay moving and they moved with us. And now we've solved at least a big part of our childcare conundrum. What would you say about the childcare costs for, say, a professional person that's going to have to look at paying for childcare? Are there any tips for that kind of person, maybe thinking in terms of trade-offs of retirement age even?
Yeah, I think that it is a trade-off. It's absolutely a trade-off. Whether you have the dad or the mom stay home, there's a trade-off there that's very real. And the costs of childcare can be just astronomically high. So high, in fact, that a lot of people start doing the math and they realize that their hourly rate for their great paying job doesn't look that great once they start really doing the math. An old book now, but written by Elizabeth Warren, called The Two Income Trap, is interesting in that regard. I mean, it's, I have it on my shelf. It must be 35, 40 years old, but it's interesting in that regard, really showing that we're in a position where dual income is almost a necessity, and that has negative ramifications. So affordability of, especially of homes, and you know, we talked about homes earlier, affordability of homes is really the biggest driver for a lot of parents to say, no, we need to be able to make this much money. So it's real. Do the math and figure out the time you're spending, all of the inputs that go into the job. Look at creative ways to freelance, still keep your skills up. Look for ways where you could say, hey, I'm going to do this. I might try and just go freelance for the first few years of this little baby's life, or I might try and be flexible here or there. But in this day and age, I'll say this word carefully, it's easier than ever to be creative about how to solve that issue, but it does take creativity and like eyes wide open to the costs. So Julie and I have been blessed that we've always been able to lean on my income when I was an accountant. It wasn't a lot, and we were living really tight, but it worked. And then as YNAB has grown, we've always just said, hey, she's got her hands full. The idea of trying to do it any other way, it seems almost impossible. But it can be done with how people can, the gig economy is allowing people to really look at things from a different angle and keep skills up that are needed and things like that.
Yeah, like some of the men and women on our team, one of the reasons specifically they wanted to work with us is because we allow that flexibility, where we've got dads that want to be able to be available for their elementary school kids when they get home, so they stop doing consults at 3 p.m. And then we've got moms that have young kids at home that are sometimes playing in the background of our meetings, but that doesn't bother us at all. Like, a lot of the team members have kids. So I think that that's definitely some great advice. In terms of easier than ever, I definitely know that that doesn't necessarily mean cheaper than ever, right?
No.
So like easier than ever, I guess there's care.com. There's a lot of ways to research childcare options on the web, which we didn't have back in this 80s and 90s. And sometimes, that word trade-offs comes to mind, like you said. I think, Jesse, that's a great word to repeat, because there are trade-offs, and sometimes the best option is not necessarily low stress. So one example that comes to mind is a physician who was supporting her mom who lived in Texas and she was in Michigan. She was struggling with childcare costs. And I sort of asked, well, since you're supporting your mother down in Texas, what about having her come up and helping you with childcare in Michigan? Like, I'm sure you've thought about that, or at least ruled it out, or one way or the other. And she's like, yeah, like that's not something that I think I would prefer to do. Well, then it's like, well, but then you're choosing not a no stress option, which is high stress, figuring out that childcare expense and budgeting for that and paying it, right? But then at least there's that backup option that you're saying that's not going to work best for me and my family, right? In terms of trade-offs, like, do you see people really embrace that when they start realizing that personal finance is a lot of it? It's just sort of this game of trade-offs, or are trade-offs really difficult for some people? What would you say to that?
I think the clearer they are on what they really care about, the clarity that you have there comes from the trade-offs. And also the more clarity you have helps you appreciate what you're actually doing. So when you're clear on what you love, what you want, what you truly desire, and then your money is doing that your effort is doing that, your energy is going toward that, it can feel good even when it's hard. I think the clarity is a lot of times what we're missing, where we just don't really know what we want. And so we're just kind of floating, and that does not feel good. So to the extent that the budget and the exercise of budgeting can help us gain clarity around our true priorities, then even if something is hard, it still feels good. And that goes back to waking up at 4:40 in the morning or whatever it is, digging in and working on something hard, you know, showing some grit, as Angela Duckworth would talk about in her book. That's what we're looking for. We're not looking for easy. We're just looking for right for us. And that's a lifelong process.
Yeah, I'm just going to, you know, give people permission here to not feel bad about this 4:40 thing. So I wake up at 6, feed baby and change baby's diaper. And then I go back to bed. I put her back in the crib and I go back to bed. And then I wake up at 7:30 or whatever. Then we start our day. You know, it definitely depends on which morning person, evening person you are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
A couple YNAB specific questions. So one thing that I like to do is any kind of recurring bills, like phone bill or gas or something, I like to name it like gas the 15th or something. And then I know that it's going to come in on the 15th of the month. And then in some cases, I've seen like, hey, we didn't get this bill canceled because it comes in at a certain time of month and I see it came in when we have already moved addresses. That's kind of like a random hack that it's not necessarily like told to you in YNAB, hey, go do this, you know, or the software doesn't tell you to do that, but it's a really neat feature you can build in for yourself. What other kind of hacks or tricks have you seen people use the software for unintentionally as developers that have helped people out over the years? Are there any kind of interesting sort of loopholes or hacks people have used it for?
Well, one of the biggest hacks is people end up using it for their business, which I never originally intended. And now I use it for my business as well. I use it for managing cash in my business, not necessarily for the accounting because we have to do accrual accounting. But yeah, that's the biggest hack is, for some reason with dentists, it kind of took a little bit. And we have dentists that will write to us and say, you know, this is a handful of times when they just say, hey, this has really changed my practice because they're orienting more around cash and what is this money going to do? And going back to those trade-offs again, they're pickier about what their money is spent on in the business. And they're looking for ROI in a more structured, targeted way. Where a lot of times with business money, we can just be like, oh, it's deductible. So, oh, it's kind of cheap. So, oh, this is fine. Be pretty hand wavy about it because there's more money flowing through. And so getting the same rigor that we can get to the personal finance side, getting that into a business changes the game. They know that they can hire when they didn't think they could afford it. They know they can expand when that was scary. They know that they've wasted money here that they can now stop. It just goes on and on. So that's probably the biggest hack. The smallest hack that people love is that you can use emojis in your category names.
Well, yeah, I can second the whole business hand wavy aspect to looking at your expenses. You know, you try to have a good handle on it, but things grow and expenses grow exponentially if your business is growing that way. And it can be really stressful and to try to figure out, hey, where's everything going and why? And yeah, I mean, that's certainly interesting. Emojis, what's the most popular emoji on YNAB?
Oh gosh. I mean, people use them for like, they're eating out. It'll be like a fork and plate and spoon. I mean, we don't look in people's budgets to like gather data on any of that at all, because that just no way, we're not going to do that. But people will like have screenshots and they'll share on Reddit or share on the Facebook fans group and things like that. And so, you know, if they've got a vacation category, they're going to put a little like island with the palm tree on there. I don't know. Just my second oldest, he's saving up for a driver because he thinks that's going to change his golf swing for sure, you know. And so he has a little emoji of a guy swinging a golf club with really good follow through, you know. So you have that. We'll see how it works for him.
That's awesome. A lot of our people are paying down student loan debt or saving for tax bombs associated with forgiveness if they're going in the private sector, or they're saving for a public service loan forgiveness, like side fund in case that program goes away. All of those would be goals that they could set up and track in something like YNAB, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those are unique, but totally known, you know, in the sense you're saying, I don't know if this is going to work. I'm going to squirrel away some money just in case, or I'm going to have a big bill, a large, very infrequent bill that will be those taxes due on forgiven loans. And I'll save up for that. Yeah, that's totally smart. And it's a lot like saving up for a vacation. It's just totally sad, but same idea. So,
yeah. And you guys have a lot of workshops, YouTube videos, stuff, because I mean, YNAB, I'm going to admit it is something that takes a little bit of time to learn. It's not a plug and play in 30 seconds and you're done, but it's also kind of like going to the gym or exercising or eating right, once you figure out how to do it, it's this amazing return on investment of your time. What would you suggest that people are interested in trying it? What kind of resources educationally would they need to look towards first to try to get set up right?
We have a getting started video series that people can use, and you can accelerate it and watch it at 1.5 speed to kind of make it go even quicker. But we're pretty efficient with what we say and what we show. And we've been doing this for so long that there's barely a wasted word in those. And so in that regard, you can watch the videos on demand. But if you want live help, you can always go to one of our workshops. We run probably 150 a week that are live with a real teacher there, and you can ask them questions specifically about your situation. I can almost guarantee that any question you ask, they will already have answered dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of times. So it's rare that anyone can stump one of our teachers. And if that doesn't work, or it doesn't fit your schedule, any of those, 150 or so sessions, then you could always just reach out to us and use the live chat. Our support people, they're just second to none as far as being able to understand someone's situation and give them very targeted, very specific advice that just delivers. We're an education company, so we need to teach people. We're trying to teach you a new way, a completely new way of thinking about your money. And so that requires some hands-on effort on our part and on YNAB's part.
Yeah, I have to reach out to them before. They're very good. Now, in terms of, and last thing, apps. You also have apps, I think, at least on iPhone. I know you can even put stuff in on your phone. Do you see a lot of take up with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, mobile, Android or iPhone, they're our fastest growing channels for sure. And yeah, the best thing you could do is you're sitting in a store and you're thinking, should I buy this? And you pull out your phone, you check YNAB, you see that the tools category is flush. And so you decide to buy the impact driver and you don't feel guilty about it. That's a good thing. Now you have an impact driver and no guilt. This is good. So in that regard, you're checking beforehand. You're saying, you're just asking the budget, can I afford this? And then you know the answer and you don't feel guilty. So do that. And then when you spend the money, you record it on the phone. We're pretty smart about it. We'll recognize, oh, you're in Home Depot again. And so we will say, well, we'll pre-fill the payee. So it's Home Depot. We'll pre-fill the category. It's quick. It's a quick little flow. A few extra seconds. You don't have to necessarily keep the receipt. You just remember the total for 10 seconds, then you're on your way.
Yeah. Last question. And again, I just want people to know this was not a sponsored thing. This Jesse didn't give me any money to be on the show. We wanted him to be on the show. This is because I use YNAB. I think you guys would really benefit from using it. So where should people go if they want to try out this for managing their own budget?
Yeah. So youneedabudget.com. But we've got a bunch of professionals here that are in a hurry, type YNAB.com. We want you to just give it a shot. It's a 34-day free trial. And we don't ask for a credit card up front, and then we're super sneaky and charge you for it. That's the opposite of what we want to have happen here. So we want you to intentionally, eyes wide open, recognize that this is changing how I'm thinking. This is changing my behavior and therefore changing my finances. And then you pay us and we will just go on our way, keep doing our thing.
YNAB.com, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being on the show, Jesse. I hope you help our people use their money and give it a job and live a lot more intentionally with their finances.
I hope so too.